Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the February-March issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine.
Western Justice. Dave Duquette takes a stand for rodeo tradition and the Western lifestyle with his organization's innovative and proactive Western Sports Industry Coalition. Seeing the logos of most every major organization in rodeo scrolling across the screen of the single website will make any rodeo fan stop and take notice. Seemingly banding together without industry rivalry, the names of some of the most prominent groups in the sport appear on the Western Justice website under the organization's innovative and proactive Western Sports Industry Coalition. Western Justice defines itself as a membership-based, nonprofit organization that engages in work related to political action in an effort to preserve and protect the Western lifestyle and related livelihoods and industry events. One of the group's main initiatives is the Western Sports Industry Coalition, formed on the heels of an attempt to ban the sport of rodeo in the city of Los Angeles, explains President of Western Justice Dave Duquette. Duquette felt the Western horse industry, which he cites as the United States' biggest domestic horse base, was ill-represented on Capitol Hill. After being involved with other political action groups over the years, he decided to start his own in 2020. Western Justice would be a membership-based organization, so small even donors could leverage their ability to help. The people that are the most passionate about wanting to help are generally people who don't have any extra money at all, Duquette says. Horse people, if you're not already wealthy to start with, you spend every last dime on your disposable income on your horses, he says, only half-joking. His membership-based organization allows like-minded people of all means to be involved and have their voices and values heard. The Western lifestyle world could be, without a doubt, the strongest, most powerful lobby group in the United States, Duquette says. We could go fix so much if we just came together under one umbrella and showed solidarity. Western Justice's efforts have attracted some high-profile support from well-known rodeo athletes, horsemen, and even 4E James Smith, the former rodeo cowboy-turned-actor who plays Lloyd on the hit television series Yellowstone. But it's not just about attracting the support of big names, according to Duquette. He's hoping to make everyone aware of the work of Western Justice. Spreading awareness is a role Duquette has perfected over his years of publicizing issues and lobbying in Washington. His work in the Capitol takes him far from his home in Hermiston, Oregon, and working the hills of Congress is a long way from serving in the United States Marine Corps and working as a ranch cowboy and horse trainer for 2 decades. But when he perceived that his way of life was coming under fire, he turned to lobbying 15 years ago. I started seeing that certain animal rights groups were trying to take down our industry, and there weren't a lot of people standing up to preserve the tradition, says Duquette, who calls himself fairly stubborn. I've got a lot of try in me, he says, and that perseverance helped him persist in educating others in the horse industry about the problems he saw on the horizon. At first, he says, a lot of people thought he was crazy for sounding an alarm, but awareness grew, eventually leading to uniting a wide range of Western organizations under the umbrella of Western Justice to meet the challenges. The dangers to the industry were and remain far-ranging. According to Duquette, beyond the attempted ban of rodeo events, he points out that some legislation could alert or even end a horseman's ability to ride on show horses. The best defense for Duquette is a strong offense. We're growing, not to the numbers I want to be yet, but I'm hoping that's going to change, he says. We're starting to make a lot of headway, and a lot more people are understanding the value of grassroots. Duquette credits the expertise of his largely volunteer team in everything from the horse and ranching industry to social media marketing and communications with helping Western Justice gain steam. I've got a great team. They believe in the cause and they believe in what we're doing. And he hopes their work inspires others, especially young people, to be proactive in protecting and promoting the Western lifestyle and what it stands for, no matter the odds against them.
Hello, this is Michael, reading from the archives of True West Magazine. December 1958 edition. Tequila and gunpowder. Only 40 years ago, on the Texas-Mexican border along the Rio Grande, Americans never knew when the banditos would strike across the river. This is the story of one such raid. By Wally George. Texas, in 1916, along the Rio Grande, was a dangerous place to live. A shallow river and lonesome. The Rio Grande has never been a detriment to those who wish to cross illegally. After leaving El Paso, it winds and twists its way through 600 miles of arid mountain ranges to the lower valley, and only once at Presidio, Texas, is it crossed by a single wooden bridge. 1916 was the big year for bandits. Mexico was a turmoil of revolution. For 6 years, one president after another had fallen to the bandit revolutionists. Pancho Villa, Zapata, Carranza, Huerta, all revolutionists, all bandits. And the Rio Grande was too shallow and too lonesome to restrict the battlegrounds. 130 miles down the river from Presidio, in the very bottom of the lonesome Big Bend country, a small detachment of 9 troops of the 14th Cavalry was stationed at Glen Springs. This little establishment consisted of the 9 troops, a store run by E.K. Ellis and C.G. Compton, and a Candelilla wax plant. The plant, owned and operated by Cap Wood and Oscar Montell, distilled a crude wax from the greasy Candelilla bush. 22 miles farther down the river was Boquillas, Texas. At Boquillas was a store run by Jesse Deemer. Across the river in the cliffs of Del Carmen Mountains was a silver mine worked by 3 Americans. The detachment of soldiers under Sergeant Smith had been sent to the area for protection against bandits. Sergeant Smith considered himself about the unluckiest man alive. On that night of May 5th, 1916, he bemoaned his fate. 14 years in the Army, and what do I get? He complained to Private Richard Collot. I get stationed right in the middle of the damnedest hunk of nowhere I ever seen. Glen Springs. He spat. The sergeant was not far from right. It was lousy duty. A small cluster of sun-baked adobe huts, a single store, and a stinking wax distillery comprised the lot. The nearest thing that resembled a town was Alpine, 120 miles of washed-out dirt road to the north. A 12-hour drive for a car. But all they had were horses. It was lousy duty. At 11 o'clock that night, C.G. Compton, clerk of the Ellis store, was brought to the door by a discreet knocking. An apologetic Mexican, hat in hand, stood in the moonlight. Pardon me, senor, he said. "The soldiers here. How many are there?" 9, said Compton. "Those are their quarters." He indicated 3 adobe huts 100 yards away. The Mexican mumbled thanks and faded into the darkness. Compton, curious, closed the door and peeked out a window. Through the night, outside, he saw scurrying dozens of sombreroed figures hurrying toward the soldiers' huts. A bandit attack. When he realized what was happening, he hurried into the bedroom where his 3 motherless children lay sleeping. Quietly, he woke them up. "Get dressed," he whispered. Then, with his daughter, age 6, he slipped out the back, leading her through the darkness to the house of a Mexican woman a half mile away. But before he got back, after his 2 boys, ages 4 and 10, he heard the firing begin. First a shot, then an answer, and another. Then the night broke into an angry staccato of rifle fire. "My boys," he whispered to himself. He had cautioned them to stay in the darkened house and not to open the door. But when the firing began, the younger one could not resist the temptation. A Mexican, taking shelter around the corner of the house, saw the door open and the small head peek out. "Miren los gringos," screamed the Mexican, and fired. He shot off half of Tommy Compton's face, then shot him again and darted over his body into the house, 2 other bandits behind him. From the far corner of the room, the older boy, Robert, looked at them fearfully. The bandit raised his rifle. "No," said one of the men who had come in with him. "Está loco." He tapped his head warningly and indicated the child. The 3 Mexicans studied the child for a moment, then turned and left the house. Robert Compton was afflicted, a deaf mute. The superstitious bandits still clung to their Indian beliefs. It is bad luck to harm one who is loco. The bandits, nearly 200 of them, turned their attention to the 9 soldiers. Under Sergeant Smith and the soldiers had all reached their cook shack, a sturdy adobe building with a tin roof covered with grass. For 3 hours, the fight dragged on, with the soldiers still in their underwear, holding off the Mexicans. Then the bandits got a barrel of kerosene from the wax distillery. They soaked bundles of rags in it. Lighting and throwing the crude firebombs at the shack, they were able to ignite the grass thatching on the tin roof. Inside, the shack was like an oven. The 9 soldiers cringed beneath the heat, but kept their positions at the windows. Then they started to break. Private Cohen, unable to stand the heat any longer, scrambled out the window headfirst. A shotgun blast from 10 yards away disintegrated his face. Privates Collot and Rogers simultaneously barreled out another window. Collot got 50 yards over the rocks before he fell, shot to pieces. Rogers, firing as he ran, reached the hillside 100 yards away. Suddenly, dark shadows rose up from the bushes around him. A scattered series of shots, and Rogers fell. He struggled to one knee. At least 20 of the Mexicans were all around him. Even though he was wounded 9 times, Rogers fired into them till his gun was empty. He killed 4 before he died. 200 yards from where the 6 remaining soldiers fought for their lives, the tin building of the wax distillery reflected the glow of the blazing cook shack. Its doors hung ajar where the bandits had torn them open. Nothing inside except the barrel of kerosene had been worth taking. The owners, Cap Wood and Oscar Montell, lived in a hut 300 yards past the distillery. They had been awakened by the gunfire. They decided to investigate. Better take a roundabout way, they decided. That precaution probably saved their lives. they made a wide circle through the brush toward the troop area. The brush in the Big Bend country is not conducive to night walks, however, and they got floundered in a stretch of cactus. It took nearly 2 hours to pick their way through the prickly patch. By the time they worked their way back to the area, they knew it was no Cinco de Mayo celebration. "My God," whispered Cap Wood. "A raid. We better get help." He whispered too loud. Three shadows materialized a few yards in front. "Quién vive?" shouted the front shadow. "Quién vive?" Wood and Montel froze. "Quién es?" replied Wood, hoping it was the correct answer. It was not. It was the wrong answer. "Quién vive" was a standard password among the Mexicans during the revolutions. The correct answer would have been "Viva Villa" or "Viva Carranza," depending on the crowd. Wood, the instant he answered, heard the click of a pistol hammer. "Run, Oscar!" he shouted to his companion as he dived into the cactus. The blast of the gunfire was a second too late. Wood and Montel scrambled through the thorns to the safety of darkness. The Mexicans, without the motivating influence of fear, did not follow them into the cactus. It was soldiers that they were after. After 4 hours of fighting, Sergeant Smith and the five remaining troops still had possession of the cook shack. The Mexicans kept a steady rain of gunfire into the building, but the soldiers, only two of them still unwounded, returned the fire and kept the bandits at bay. During the fighting, several of the Mexicans broke into Ellis's store. Only a few minutes earlier, Ellis, who had a wooden leg, and his wife had slipped away. Like excited kids, the Mexicans tumbled over the counter in the general store, dragging clothes off the shelves, ripping open sacks. There was a shout. From the back of the store, one of the bandits exuberantly held up a bottle. The others looked, then crowded around him. In a few seconds, they all had bottles. Rushing out of the store, they carried armloads of the fiery Soto cactus whiskey to their brethren who were besieging the cook shack. In less than half an hour, there was not a sober bandit. Staggering, crazy drunk on Sotol, they once more turned their attention to the soldiers. They wanted to kill the Americans, but until now, they had not been especially interested in risking their own lives to do it. After all, what fun is it to be a bandit if you get killed? But now their leader, Rodriguez Ramirez, who with Natividad Alvarez, a Villista colonel who had organized the raid, staggered to his feet from where he had been crouched in a ditch. With one hand, he grasped a rifle. With the other, he grasped a nearly empty Sotol bottle. He lifted it to his lips, drained it, and flung it toward the cook shack. "Mueren los gringos," he screamed. He scrambled toward the shack. "Mueren los gringos," echoed from others. "Killed the Americans." A dozen more staggered in behind Ramirez. Over the rocky ground, they surged toward the shack with the still smoking roof over the dead bodies of two of their comrades who had died earlier. When they almost reached the shack, a savage volley of shots poured from all the windows. Even the four wounded soldiers were propped up, dumping lead into the Mexicans. Ramirez fell dead. Before the disorganized bandits could collect themselves, eight more fell dead. This cooled the ardor of most of the others, who, under the influence of the Sotol, had decided there were things more fun than fighting. To hell with the revolution. The gringos, the fighting. Viva Sotol! At 4 a.m, after almost 5 hours, the bandits began to withdraw. Part of them crossed into the Rio Grande back into Mexico. The majority, however, not being party poopers, decided they could hold out as long as the Sotol. They, under Colonel Alvarez, traveled 20 miles down the river, still on the Texas side, to a point above Boquillas, and continued celebrating into the next day. At daybreak, they had an interruption. The unmistakable clatter of a Model T Ford brought the bandits to their guns. They relaxed as the car chugged into sight. It was only one person, a middle-aged, dignified man with a bushy shock of gray hair. He was Dr. Homer Powers, the area physician. Dr. Powers, who lived at Boquillas, had left at dawn to make a call at the Terlingua Mercury Mines, 78 miles up the river. When he drove into the band of Mexicans, who were camped all over the road, a few of them were sober enough to explain that he was their prisoner. He was lucky. They would have been happy to kill him, but with his suit and his car, he seemed like a very important gringo. They decided to take him along to Mexico and hold him for ransom. Although he knew nothing of the Glen Springs raid, Dr. Powers soon gathered the story. Soon after his capture, he heard the rattling of gunfire down the river at Boquillas. It was with great relief to Powers, shortly after mid-morning, that the bandit camp had visitors. Over the rocky road they came, strung out for a quarter mile, 100 sombreroed, bodegoed Mexicans on horseback. Trudging along on foot were two prisoners, Jesse Deemer and his hired Negro, Monroe Payne. The bandits, after raiding Deemer's store, decided to take him along and maybe collect a ransom. Under the encouraging influence of Sotol, it never occurred to the bandits that gringo soldiers would come out and punish them. But the word got out. Already, telephone wires were buzzing. Posses were being formed. This was Friday afternoon, May 6th. Back at Glen Springs, E.K. Ellis and his wife had managed to slip away during last night's raid. Ellis was a peg-legged man. His flight over the rocky terrain, 11 miles, left his wooden leg a splintered stump. At daylight on Friday, Sheriff Alan Walton of Alpine got the phone call. He wired El Paso, headquarters of the military district. At El Paso, Major George T. Langhorne, commanding officer of the 8th Cavalry Regiment, jumped into action. Within 5 hours, two trains of cavalrymen and horses rolled out of El Paso headed for the Big Bend, 400 miles down the river. The isolation of the Big Bend gave the advantage to the bandits. There was no hurry on their part. It was only when the Sotol gave out that the Mexicans realized with regret that their party was over. Well, back to Mexico and La Revolucion. Putting Deemer and Payne in Dr. Powers' Model T, they made him drive it across the river into Mexico. There was one more stop to make, at the Boquillas silver mines. These mines, on the Mexican side of the river in the towering cliffs of the Del Carmen Mountains, was run by three Americans. The bandits made Dr. Powers go along alone to the diggings in his Ford. When the three miners, who recognized Dr. Powers, left their guns and the safety of the mines, the banditos charged out of hiding and surrounded them. Three more hostages for ransom. The Mexicans first decided to kill the miners. Luckily, there was a truck at the mine, which the bandits admired but could not drive. They decided to take the miners along to drive the truck. Since they now had a truck, there was no need for the Model T. Half of the group went ahead, taking Jesse Deemer and Monroe Payne. The other half remained at the mine. They had a chore to do. Hooking horses to the Ford, they dragged it to the top of a high bluff overlooking the Rio Grande. Laughing and jumping like kids, they released the brakes and let it roll. The car shot forward over the cliff, tumbled end over end, and finally disappeared into the Rio Grande in a mountain of foam. Dr. Powers was not too upset over the loss of his car. He had overheard the Mexicans arguing whether or not to include him in it, just for laughs. After loading Powers and the three miners on the truck, the band turned south toward the interior. But because of the impossible Mexican roads, the truck was not able to keep up with the horsemen. It continued to fall behind, despite threats from the bandits. Finally, when only eight Mexicans, including Colonel Alvarez, remained with the truck, the Americans managed to get it stuck in the sand, crossing a dry creek bed. The Mexicans growled and waved their guns. That did no good. The truck was stuck, or so it appeared to the Mexicans, who knew nothing about machinery. The driver, racing the motor and clanging the gears, was slipping the clutch just enough to roll the truck gently forward, then back again. Suddenly, the engine began to sputter. It died. The driver cranked the starter, but nothing happened. He had the ignition off. "It needs water," he explained to the Mexicans. "It won't go without water." The Mexicans went into conference. To go for water or to shoot the gringos? That was the question. They decided to go get the water. They could shoot the gringos later. Four of them went ahead to a waterhole, leaving Colonel Alvarez and the three others to guard the Americans. The driver decided to try starting the truck one more time. It started. "Maybe it was cooled off," he explained to the guards. He would try again to get it out of the sand. He gunned it. No luck. It was stuck fast. Dr. Powers and the other two Americans then got behind and pushed while the driver gunned the motor. This time, it surged forward a few inches, but not quite enough to surge out of the sand. Only a little more manpower was needed. With considerable reluctance, the Mexicans laid their rifles against a rock and joined in behind the truck to push. As the seven men shoved with all their might, to the accompaniment of the roaring engine, Dr. Powers suddenly straightened up. "Now," he shouted, "gun it." The truck lurched forward. The four bandits spilled on their faces into the sand. By the time they clambered to their feet, they were staring down the barrels of their own rifles. The miners plowed into the surprised bandits using the rifles as clubs. After beating them unconscious, they dumped them onto the truck, drove it out of the sand, and took the four captives back to Texas. They reached the north bank of the Rio Grande in time to meet the posse from Alpine. The posse decided not to cross into Mexico until the troops from El Paso arrived. The troops, 600 of them, got there at mid-afternoon the next day. They could not cross the river until they were joined by Major Langhorne. The major, chafing with the delay, finally got permission to cross into Mexico. This was an important precedent. Until this raid, he had been allowed to chase the bandits only to the banks of the Rio Grande. The Mexicans knew that if they could reach the border ahead of the American troops, they were safe from pursuit. But now, May 8, 1916, Major Langhorne, traveling in a huge Cadillac 8, joined his troops on the bank of the Rio Grande. "We're going into Mexico," he said. The main group of bandits still held the hostages Jesse Deemer and Monroe Payne. They had not anticipated pursuit. When they learned Major Langhorne and 600 cavalrymen were on their trail, panic began to seep into their ranks. They zigzagged all across the northern wastelands of Mexico, but the major hung on. Traveling in his Cadillac 8, he continued to close down the distance. The roads were not automobile roads, but wagon trails, in many places barely passable to wagons. Still, Langhorne and his troops stayed behind the bandits. Closer they got. Finally, after nearly 2 weeks, he established contact with the enemy. The Mexicans were becoming more panicky. They swung west from the state of Cahuilla into Chihuahua. At the town of El Pino, Chihuahua, the bandits decided to make a stand. They were tired of running, but they were not ready to die either. They still had their bargaining power. Taking up positions in the sun-baked adobe huts of El Pino, firing from the windows, they stopped Langhorne's advance on the morning of May 22nd. In the volley of shots that followed, 10 of the Mexicans were killed, and Langhorne was able to take the huts at the edge of town. While he was regrouping for another assault, the bandits sent a villager under a white flag into his camp. They wanted peace, the men explained. Give them a chance to escape, and they would release Deemer and Payne. Otherwise... The major chewed his gray mustache. His orders said to rescue the two Americans, but after 2 weeks of pursuit, it seemed a shame not to really punish the bandits. Well, he was a military man. He followed orders. So it was after that, after 16 days in Mexico, traveling 538 miles without losing a single man, Major Langhorne returned to Texas with his mission accomplished. After the Glen Springs and Boquillas raid, the Big Bend was made into a military district. The 6th Cavalry was sent to Marfa. Then a few months later, it was replaced by the 8th under Colonel Langhorne. Today, the establishments of Glen Springs and Boquillas, Texas, do not exist. When the Big Bend of the Rio Grande was made into a national park, they were abandoned. Where Boquillas was, now stands a ranger station. At Glen Springs is nothing. A few crumbling adobe walls, the ruins of the old wax distillery. Occasionally, among the rocks, the broken glass from Soto bottles. Hello, this is Michael, reading from the archives of True West Magazine, December 1958 edition. The exciting story of the Mochila Mail, a brief but thrilling chapter in the history of transportation in the Far West, the rise and fall of the Pony Express, by Leslie G. Kennan. I tell you it won't work. Absurd idea. A bunch of riders carrying mail across country wild and unsettled, across Indian territory, using unmapped trails, and depending upon a string of outposts from Missouri to California. It would never work. Alexander Majors stared at his impractical partner, considering that he must have lost his mind to even envision such a wild scheme as a Pony Express in the year of 1860. Majors knew that William H. Russell had always been a visionary. His other partner, W.B. Waddell, simply wasn't a businessman. It was he, Alexander Majors, who carried the burden of making the firm of Russell, Majors, and Waddell an economic success. The going was rough sometimes, especially when Russell came up with one of his crackpot schemes to make a fortune, such as now. Waddell, as usual, kept out of the argument. He was content to go along with whatever Majors and Russell decided. His tactics had paid off. With little effort on his part, he had already amassed a considerable fortune. "I tell you, Majors," roared Russell, "it will work." Right now, Congress is in a hot debate over the routing of mail. A fast mail route is vital to both the North and the South. The Free Staters don't like the Butterfield route. Why, man, if we play our cards right, we've got a gold mine in this Pony Express. Top men in Congress have asked me to go through with it. Senator Gwin in California told me the governor would go along with us 100%. And he assured us of their backing on the floor of Congress. Majors snorted. Backing? How much cash did he say they had put up? I don't mean backing in money. Damn it, Majors, can't you understand there are some things more important than money? Name one. I notice that you seem to enjoy living well. The argument continued, and as it developed, the only thing that sold Majors on the idea of the Pony Express was the fact that Russell had already promised Senator Gwynn that he would do it. Congress had been notified of the plan. Majors was not a man to back down on any promise made by his firm, even if made by a half-witted partner who couldn't see the dangers involved. Quite possibly, his decision was strongly influenced by the fact that a government contract for carrying the mails was practically assured. Conflict between Majors and Russell was inevitable due to their dissimilar backgrounds. Waddell, the third partner, was of small importance, and so little information about him is on record. William Hepburn Russell was born January 31, 1812, in Burlington, Vermont, the son of William Eaton and Myrtilla Hepburn Russell. His father was a soldier in the War of 1812 who died 2 years after the start of hostilities. His mother then married a Colonel Bangs, and the family moved to Missouri. At this time, Missouri was the outpost of Western expansion, still wild, but rapidly becoming civilized to a degree where it later became known as the Mother of the West. To this changing land of diversified interests and viewpoints came William H. Russell as a sensitive, emotional boy. He began to work at 16 as a clerk, later becoming a merchant, and finally partner in a bank at Richmond, Missouri. On June 9, 1835, he married Harriet Elliott Warder, a preacher's daughter, and by the late 40s was engaged in freighting on government contracts. Alexander Majors was born October 4, 1814, near Franklin, in Simpson County, Kentucky, the son of Loriania Kelly and Benjamin Majors, a native of North Carolina. The family moved to what is now Lafayette County, Missouri, in 1819. They acquired an extensive farm with saw and flour mills in Jackson County, living there from 1825 to 1858. Alexander worked on the farm and as a miller's boy. On November 6, 1834, he married Catherine Stallcup, and the young couple began farming on their own. At this time, Majors was having a struggle reconciling his deep religious convictions with a keen, practical business sense. In this, he was successful. In August of 1848, Majors undertook the carrying of freight from Independence to Santa Fe with an outfit of 6 wagons and teams. His first trip, completed in 92 days, cleared $1,500. Majors was perhaps the oddest boss freighter ever to ply the storied Santa Fe Trail. He refused to work on Sunday and made his men pledge, as he later made his Pony Express riders pledge, not to cuss, drink, gamble, treat animals cruelly, or do anything else that is incompatible with the conduct of a gentleman. He paid good wages, otherwise it is to be feared he would have had difficulty hiring a crew. Russell joined Majors and W.B. Waddell in a freighting partnership December 28, 1854, with an operating center at Leavenworth, Kansas. 4 years later, the partnership became the firm of Russell, Majors, and Waddell. Business grew rapidly under Majors' shrewd management. He took full responsibility for all the business on the roads, while Russell and Waddell financed and purchased. Majors hired more than 4,000 men and used 40,000 oxen and 1,000 mules. Shipments traveled in trains of about 25 wagons each, with stations several miles apart, a system later used in the Pony Express. Each wagon had 12 oxen and a teamster. and each train had 30 oxen in reserve, 5 mules, a wagon master, and some extra men. The profits of the ambitious venture in 1855-56 were $300,000. In 1857, the firm's operations were expanded when a contract was obtained for supplying the army ordered to Utah. In May 1859, Russell and a John S. Jones opened a stage line from Leavenworth to Denver, which was taken over by the firm within a year. In February 1860, the Central Overland and Pikes Peak Express Company was chartered with Russell as president. The line ran first-class coaches through to California. Mail required 23 days for the journey from St. Louis to San Francisco. St. Joseph itself, in the days prior to the Pony Express, was a transportation center. The town had been named for the patron saint of Joseph Ribideau, who as early as 1803 had traded with the Indians at Black Snake Hills. The name was changed from Ribideau's trading post to St. Joseph in 1843. The Pony Express was ready to go within 60 days after the decision was made. It was, all things considered, a masterpiece of organization. And it is significant that in all the mails carried by Pony Express, only one pouch was lost. In another case of lost mail, the rider was waylaid and murdered, but the mail was found intact and promptly delivered. In later days, riders went only 10 or 12 miles before changing horses, which they did in 2 minutes or less, due to the closeness of the stations. Mail traveled from Washington, D.C. to San Francisco, an airline distance of 3,500 miles, in only 14 days. This was an average speed of 250 miles a day by steamboat, railroad, magnetic telegraph, and horseflesh. The San Francisco Herald stated on April 16, 1860, "The Pony Express has performed a feat which excites the wonder and admiration of all." The restriction placed on riders, other than the strict moral ones imposed by majors, was great. All the riders chosen were small but sinewy. Probably none weighed over 135 pounds, and many little more than 100. Riders and other employees of the firm received wages of from $40 to $150 a month and were housed and fed at company expense. Saddles were specially designed, hybrids of the Western and jockey types, lightweight with saddle horns and cattles for comfort in riding long distances. They were only about a third of the weight of the saddles used by the vaqueros, the type then generally used in California. Most of these special saddles were made by Israel Landis's famous saddlery in St. Louis. An interesting feature was the mochila, or leather blanket, thrown over the saddle with holes for the horn and cantle. Ordinary mail pouches, those used for regular mail, were much too awkward and cumbersome to be used for this new service. Specially made mochilas, adapted from the Spanish, were made with four cantinas, locked pockets of leather fastened to the mochila, and lined with oilskin to protect the precious mail from the sweat of the animal, and from the rain and snow, or from streams should a rider be forced to swim his mount. As the rider straddled his horse, there was a pocket in front of and behind each thigh. Only the agents at either end of the line and specially designated officials had keys to these locked pockets. But the way pocket was left open for the messages taken or delivered along the route and for the way bill on which the name of the station and time of arrival and departure were to be written. The route was across Kansas into Nebraska near Rock Creek, and on to Fort Kearney by way of 32 Mile Creek, following the Platte for some distance, thence northwest to Fort Laramie. Riders crossed the foothills at the base of the Rockies at South Pass, went on to Fort Bridger, Salt Lake City, Carson City, Placerville, Folsom, and Sacramento. From there, the mail traveled by fast boat to San Francisco. There are many fabulous and fascinating stories connected with riders of the Express. Jack H. Keatley, the Joyous Jockey, who operated on the route out of St. Joe, in payment of a bet, once rode 340 miles without rest. Jack claimed that Alex Carlisle was the first to carry the mail out of St. Joe, though claims are registered for several others, the most often mentioned being Johnny Fry. In Nevada during 1860, a pony galloped into a way station with the rider slumped over the saddle horn, his lifeless body pierced by several arrows. So tight was the clutch of his hand that the pony's mane had to be cut from his grasp. The gallant mount had carried on, bringing the mail through safely. Pony Bob Haslam, carrying the news of Lincoln's election, was attacked by Indians, but reached his relief station after a remarkable ride of 120 miles in 8 hours, his jaw shattered by an arrow and his left arm badly wounded. Not long after this harrowing experience, Bob was back, carrying the mail. The distance regularly covered by a Pony Express rider ranged from 35 to 75 miles a day, depending on the terrain he covered. Speed, come hell or high water, had to average 9 miles per hour. But delays caused by blizzards, torrential rains, excessive darkness, exhausting summer heat, and unforeseen accidents had to be reckoned with. Some outstanding riders averaged 20 miles per hour, but the overall average was right at the scheduled figure. Every American boy in those days wanted to be a Pony Express rider. The number first assigned to this dangerous but highly exciting job was 80. They were the pick of the crop. Boys in their teens, dependable, strong, courageous, and astonishingly agile and accomplished horsemen. What they lacked in years and experience, they made up in sheer nerve and physical stamina. The financial loss to the partners was immediate and great, however. The founders had invested $100,000 originally, and $30,000 a month were required for operating expenses. Indian damage alone cost $75,000 in the first 3 months. Often, express riders were able to outdistance hostile Indians on their fleet ponies, but many men were killed while carrying the mails or at the stations, which were under frequent attack. The Pony Express was vital to rapid communication of messages at its inception. Large Eastern newspapers maintained correspondence in St. Louis to wire the news from the West as it came in via Pony Express. Western papers often headed items, "We hear from Pony Express." William N. Finney, general agent for the firm, posted bills advertising Pony Express 8 days from San Francisco to New York. The Pony Express of the Central Overland California and Pikes Peak Express Company will leave San Francisco for New York and immediate points on Friday, 20th of April, 1860, and on every Friday thereafter at 4 o'clock p.m. Schedule time from San Francisco to New York for telegraphic dispatches, 8 days. For letters, 12 days. N.B. The public will understand that by telegraphing to Carson City 27 and a half hours later, intelligence, news, messages, etc., can be sent to St. Joseph, Missouri, then by letter to San Francisco. Actual copy of poster. At the inception of the famous mail service, the Hannibal and St. Joseph Railroad carried tissue mail destined for the Pony Express's first run on April 3, 1860. Addison Clark, the road's top engineer, was told to make a record that will stand for 30 years. The route was dangerous and the roadbed not seasoned. Rails were light in those days and curves and grades not standardized. Yet the 206-mile run was covered at an average speed of 50 miles an hour, and the mail arrived at St. Joseph in time for the Pony Express to depart on schedule. The first mail carried between 60 and 80 pieces, including a message from President Buchanan to the governor of California, which had been telegraphed as far as St. Joseph. Later, the new service was to carry such important news as Lincoln's inaugural address, the fall of Fort Sumter, the call for troops at the start of the Civil War, and the bloody battle of Antietam. On that first historic run, over 1,900 miles of rough terrain, the eastbound mail came to St. Joseph in 9 days, 23 hours, and the westbound was delivered in 11 days, 12 hours. The Pony Express required 190 relay stations, one of which still stands unaltered at the Hollenberg Ranch House near Hanover, Kansas. 420 horses and 400 station keepers. Until stations could be built at points between runs, tent shelters for horses and men were erected each 12 to 15 miles. Farther on, the distance between stops was often more than 25 miles. The initial letter rate was $5 per half ounce in gold, later reduced to $1. Mail was limited to letters and telegrams, all to be written on tissue paper, which was enclosed in oilcloth as protection against severe weather. The maximum weight of any one mail was 20 pounds. Yet the entire venture, as Majors had predicted, was a crushing financial flop. The operation folded in October 1861 due to a fast-developing series of events, resulting in rendering the service obsolete almost overnight. The knockout came when telegraph wires spanned the nation and overland stages took over carrying the mails. The three partners, again according to Majors' prediction, went broke. Majors even surrendered his personal estate to help pay company debts. The Pony Express was simply a victim of bad timing, coming as it did just before the advent of transcontinental telegraph. On the 95th anniversary of its founding in St. Joseph, where the original stables have been preserved by the Getz Pony Express Foundation, U.S. Postmaster General Summerfield, in saluting its achievements, said that it was a financial failure, but a romantic triumph. It was all that and more for the exciting story of the short-lived Mochila Mail. Is the most thrilling chapter in the history of transportation in the Far West.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.